This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca, iTunes, and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Michael Walker is a psychologist working to implement the recovery model within the Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health. He also teaches postmodern consultation, an approach to helping that was earlier called postmodern therapy. Michael Walker says that the mental health profession has largely missed out on the evolution of the postmodern perspective and linguistic paradigm now prevalent in philosophy, history, the social sciences, literature, and art. In an article called The Social Construction of Mental Illness and Its Implications for the Recovery Model, Dr. Walker explains how language creates realities as opposed to discovering them. The paper suggests that what this means for the mental health profession is that mental illness, diagnoses, and associated concepts are all social constructions.
We're joined in the studio by Michael Walker. Welcome to People First Radio, Michael.
Thank you.
You acknowledge at the start of your paper that philosophy since Plato has been about the search for absolute truth through the use of reason. Tell us more about that influence.
I guess it was, 500 BC and around the time of Plato. In response to the relativism of his time, Plato posited an eternal and immutable realm of perfect forms. And that the visible world was a shadow of these forms, or just appearances. Certain philosophers, through contemplation, could use reason and access this knowledge in this realm. So here we have the birth of expert knowledge, as we postmodernists refer to. And so the Greeks revived. In the Renaissance, the Greek knowledge was revived, and as we philosophers often say that the rest of philosophy was a footnote to Plato. And part of that time, around the 17th century, Descartes and Newton were very prominent in this move towards reductionism, and so at that point, we had Descartes saying that to understand something, we break it into its component parts and see how they interact. And Newton talked about the mechanistic world and how it was like a large clock. And so together with those two things, we came up with science, a scientific method, and the idea that science and reason could reveal absolute truths or essences. So psychiatry and psychology, of course, as we know, wear the mantle of objectivity, that they're claiming their truths to be grounded in science. And the issue is not so much whether psychology and psychiatry are grounded in science when we know that they have some scientific methods. The issue really is whether science is the best modality to address human behavior and the human spirit.
You then turned your attention to linguistics in your paper, and you wrote that categories such as mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder are abstractions defined by clusters of what we've called symptoms. Tell us more about that.
If you look at any diagnosis, bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or major depression, what you have is, how do we define those? We define those by a list of symptoms, what they call symptoms, and if you have 3 out of 5 of those, say, symptoms, bingo, you qualify for the label at the top. What the diagnosis does, what's implied in that, is that there's a one-way causality. In other words, that human behavior comes from and human experience come from is ultimately the brain, and where there's aberrations in the behavior and experience, it comes from an imbalance somewhere in the brain. So that's gives some kind of justification for that abstraction. However, most of us nowadays know through cognitive science and mindfulness and cognitive behavioral therapy that the brain, the higher centers of the brain influence the lower centers, and we have this thing called neuroplasticity. And what I call that is neural correlation. We have neural correlates for behavior and the rest of the brain, towards the rest of the brain, rather than neural causality, where it just goes in one direction. So we can get rid of the abstraction. We can talk about these so-called symptoms, but again, focusing on deficiencies and what we call negative aspects just bring on more of those things. Keeps our attention on that.
This is People First Radio, only on CHLY 101.7 FM and streaming at chly.ca. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.
Postmodernism portrays many, if not all, apparent realities as social constructs subject to change inherent to time and place. Postmodernism also emphasizes the role of language, power relations, and motivations. In particular, it attacks the use of sharp classifications such as male versus female, straight versus gay, white versus black, and for our discussion today, mentally ill and mentally healthy. Michael Walker is a psychologist who has written about the social construction of mental illness. He joins us in the studio today.
Michael, you say that the mental health profession's isolation from other disciplines, such as philosophy and history, has left it with only a superficial understanding of the power of language. Tell us more about the issues related to power in your analysis.
The labels that they use are seen as existing inside the person somehow, that say schizophrenia somehow exists inside the person and is an aspect of who they are. If we understand these labels as abstractions that don't have to be there, that we can look at the so-called symptoms, and of course those things exist, problems concentrating, hearing things, mood fluctuations, those all we all agree are part of our experience of being human. We can really get rid of the abstractions and we can begin to assess the consequences of these abstractions. And one of the consequences is that these labels keep us focused on the label itself. We see what confirms the label. It focuses our attention. And normal experiences are often pathologized, and in many ways the labels are self-fulfilling because people interpret their own experience through the labels, and other people interpret through the labels as well, even normal experience, even when it's not extreme. And unfortunately, another bad side effect of that is that the growth that a person, the small baby steps are often overlooked because they don't fit the category. They're not expanded upon. They're called what we call in solution-focused therapy exceptions, and those are the building blocks for change. So in a sense, you can never escape this thing. And in the classes that I run back in Los Angeles, we basically, it's like a learning immersion, a language immersion class where I basically help people talk the language of empowerment. And we sort of insist that they talk the language of empowerment. We deconstruct the utterances that are from the medical vocabulary. And we created a whole new language. And so people are talking about projects and commitments and all kinds of wonderful things, breakthroughs. And so that becomes what we talk about now, and spontaneously people talk about this, and rather as before they were talking about their symptoms and the medication. And so it was all about that before. And so now the power of definition or the power lies in the person's ability to define their own experience. And my role is to help come up with words like commitment, that empowers their, let's say, their personal self-determination or their personal authority. So it really is about them, and we look for definitions and descriptions that open up possibilities rather than close them down with these totalizing labels.
What about the notion, though, of the chemical imbalance? Now, the chemical imbalance concept is often relied upon to furnish proof of the disease model and the reality of mental illness. Where does that all fit in?
First of all, the diagnosis implies a one-way causality, as if within the brain there's a chemical imbalance that's causing this, these experiences as well as the behaviors. However, through cognitive science now, we know that the brain is a complex system. And complex systems, we know that not only can the parts affect the whole, but the whole can affect the parts. So we know that through cognitive behavioral science, mindfulness, what I do called coaching, using the vocabulary of empowerment, we create lasting changes of feeling, behavior, and thinking, and consequently brain chemistry, as evidenced in PET scans. There's a great book called The Mind and the Brain by Jeffrey Schwartz and Sharon Begley that really gives you a great description of neuroplasticity and how the results, the research of how this two-way causality occurs. So we can say that all human behavior has neural correlates. All thinking and feeling and behaving has neural correlates, but not neural causation. Neural causation implies that it's only coming from this chemical imbalance or just the neural correlates that correlate to behavior that we prefer not to have. So this doesn't take away from the using pills as a tool, as one among many tools. It's just we want to focus on this weaker pathway where we're using other modalities, other languages to influence the higher centers of the brain so that the brain can correct itself. And these are long-lasting, no side effects. And so it's all sort of working in that direction now.
We're joined in the studio by psychologist Dr. Michael Walker, who is working in Los Angeles County to encourage the development of recovery-based approaches in the treatment of mental health issues. Michael wrote an article in 2006 called The Social Construction of Mental Illness and Its Implications for the Recovery Model. And we've been speaking with him about philosophy, linguistics, power, and cognitive science and how they've affected the mental health professions and concepts of treatment. If you're just joining us, you can find all of today's discussion in MP3 format online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.
Michael, you examine a range of consequences in your paper that are related to ignorance of the linguistic paradigm, and you touched on some of these consequences earlier in our discussion. You began in your paper with the notion of iatrogenic illnesses. Tell us more about that.
Iatrogenic illness means illness caused by the attempt at healing. And in this case, what's happening is that these labels, because of their self-fulfilling prophecy, the way they basically keep your focus on the negative aspects of a person's experience, they continue to sort of take on a life of their own, and they really limit the person's experience and begins to, even if a person didn't have meet the criteria for the so-called DSM, if you were to apply a label to them, which there's been some research on this in the past, that their behavior would begin to shape around the label. It's quite fascinating. And so another aspect of this this iatrogenic illness is that people develop what I call a patient identity. And the patient identity is very passive and very insecure. And as we know, when people are called patients and they say they have an illness and all this, we begin to treat them with kid gloves. We treat them as if they were fragile. And part of that narrative is that the salvation for a patient lies in pills. So what this does is it essentially short circuits the pathway to personal growth, which requires us to be resilient and to be able to feel our feelings and to do what we need to do anyway, feel our fears, do it anyway. So this is what I call a challenge point. At these challenge points in our life, do we go down one pathway, which is the pathway of the patient, or do we go down the other pathway, which is the pathway of personal growth, which is what the earlier caller was talking about, Tara. So that's what I'm advocating, and as long as you, that patient identity, pretty much, it's like a straitjacket, and you can tell what a patient identity sounds like by, they often say things like, I want to get better someday, I can't handle stress, someday when I feel better, I'll do more. Every fourth sentence out of their mouth is my medications or my doctor. So that's pretty much what reflects the patient identity.
Your analysis and discussion in the paper turns into a strong focus on recovery. You write that without a recovery focus, pathologizing runs rampant. Tell us more about the importance of recovery.
In California, about 10 years ago, we got something passed through a law called the Mental Health Services Act, and it provided a lot of funding, automatic funding from tax revenue from the richest 1% to go to what they call recovery services and wellness-based services. And what that did is really reorganized in many ways the way we help people and how we've structured our systems. And so recovery in many ways was born out of reaction to the medical model. And it's a focus on self-determination, choice, self-help, peer support, taking initiatives, all those things that are really having meaningful roles in life, purpose in life, being able to contribute, community, all those great things, which are very different than getting better or dealing with my illness. So it's a wonderful transition, and now we've got wellness centers, and people are doing some pretty exciting things.
This is CHLY.ca, CHLY 101.7 FM. You're listening to People First Radio.
Ignorance of the linguistic paradigm has resulted in profound iatrogenic problems, which are problems caused by attempts made at helping. Mental health professionals may be creating much of that which they are trying to cure. Michael Walker writes in his article, The Social Construction of Mental Illness and Its Implications for the Recovery Model, that the recovery model is a great advance in the movement towards client self-determination, empowerment, and independence, but that medical and psychological models are alive and well in recovery programs in the way in which they are still thought of and spoken of as essential truths.
Michael, you've written that the recovery movement reflects a humanitarian impulse that prevails despite the power of medical and psychological dogma, but that most recovery model practitioners still use the vocabulary of the medical and psychological models.
Yes, it's pretty much everywhere I go and everything I hear. My observations where I am at, located where I work, as well as when I talk to other professionals, that the wellness and recovery focus and their programs are essentially layered on top of the foundation of the medical model. Recovery means many wonderful things. Like I said a minute ago, self-determination, choice, self-help, meaning, purpose. But it, recovery also means recovery from an illness or being able to live with an illness. So ironically, it's still embedded in the medical model. So wellness is a little bit better than recovery in the sense that wellness is already in the community. You and I, we participate in wellness. So what I'm proposing is what I call a radical normalization, where we talk only in terms of warning signs, wellness signs, action plans, personal growth, commitment, and that we essentially all begin to use the same language of personal growth, and warning signs are what we used to call symptoms.
You've predicted that what you call postmodern consultation and coaching, which includes solution-focused, narrative, collaborative perspectives, you've predicted that these will build on the foundation of a post-medical psychological model world. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, there are the postmodern therapies, solution-focused, narrative, collaborative language systems that have been around for quite a while. In fact, in California, narrative and solution-focused therapies are on the marriage and family therapist licensing exam. And so that's where I got my start in this way of thinking quite a while ago. And they also lead very nicely into the world of coaching. And coaching is sort of even takes it one step further. But then again, the postmodern aspect needs to be incorporated into coaching, which is a whole nother radio show. However, there's so much that can be learned from solution focus and narrative therapy. Solution focus is about working with strengths and developing strengths and developing a compelling future. Narrative therapy offers the way of languaging and externalizing negative feelings and frees people up to live according to what they're committed to.
You also address the ongoing challenge, I guess you'd say, of demonstrating a need for services or demonstrating that services are required by an individual. And you've written that a professional can establish the need for services based on behaviors without needing to make up, quote unquote, fictive diseases.
Yes. If you're any of your callers are worried about benefits in light of this, they can rest assured that there's no conflict here. Essentially, what we're talking about when I write reports, disability reports, or things like that, or progress notes, we're really just talking about behaviors. And when you're describing a person's behaviors, you can infer certain problems with daily living and working, and that makes for an excellent justification for government funding. So I do that all the time, and I've been doing it for years, and most of my reports, ironically, get approved, so I have a pretty good batting average. And I look at those so-called disability funding as sort of a grant that people can use until they can get on their feet again. I really relanguage that. But at no point do you need to really add the totalizing vocabulary basically the DSM.
You describe yourself as experiencing what you called a moment of enlightenment before you wrote this paper. Tell us briefly about that time of your life.
Yes, I was in an immersion program at the Village in Long Beach after we got that Mental Health Services Act passed. And I was just amazed at the how wonderful. I mean, there was no distinction between the residents and the staff, and that they were working and participating and doing outreach. The consumers were. And I realized that, wow, this is an amazing program. But then when I went into the actual training, they kept saying talking about people in terms of having a mental illness and living with a mental illness. And when they go to work, just leave your mental illness at the door. So I was thinking, well, why not just never pick up your mental illness when you leave work? And so I just could not believe that they were still using all that jargon. And so I went to Mark Reagan's and I said, hey, he's the head medical director, psychiatrist. And I said, let's get together for lunch. And I tried to explain this to him at lunch, and I got a blank stare. And he didn't seem to really respond at all to it. And at that moment, I knew I had to write this article.
We have just a moment left in our discussion today, Michael. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add.
Yes, I believe that what we're dawning, not only this radical normalization, but also a whole new way of training people, utilizing a lot of the skills that they already know and concepts like mindfulness, et cetera, and CBT, but using it artfully and starting with the person's experience, the person's feelings, the person's preferences, listening and aligning with what's most important to them, and then we can use our tools to help forward the direction in which they prefer to go instead of using all that time and money to learn how to catalog people. We can move towards connection, intimacy, love, and forwarding the human spirit. So, and lastly, if you want my article, you can go to Google and type in Michael Walker Social Construction.
Thanks very much, Michael, for taking the time to join us. It was much appreciated.
Thank you.
Michael Walker has been teaching postmodern consultation since 1995. He has a private practice in Redondo Beach, California, and has been employed as a psychologist in a community mental health setting with LA County Department of Mental Health since 1991. Mike is currently part of a leadership team whose purpose it is to implement a mental health recovery model. You can find his article, The Social Construction of Mental Illness and Its Implications for the Recovery Model, online. Just use the search terms Michael Walker and Social Construction.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.